Good morning, and welcome to Friend Me, Vote For Me, Donate Now, the panel of talking heads from the Beltway looking at the social media and social networking strategies of the presidential candidates and beyond. My name is Julie Barco Germany, and I'm the director of GW's Institute for Politics, Democracy, and the Internet. And we have some great panelists here today. All of them have worked as political operatives in addition to their present day jobs. Starting on the right-hand side, my right-hand side, your left, Tanya Tarr is a political analyst at the International Office of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Colin Delaney runs ePolitics, a blog, and also a consulting company. Patrick Ruffini runs Engage DC and also started a site called Right Roots. And of course, we have Adam Connor. And I understand Adam's parents are here today. So in addition to working at Facebook, Adam is also essential to the internet. There are no bad pictures about Adam anywhere online. And he's a great part of the Facebook team. So I see a lot of Beltway folks in the audience, and I hope you will all forgive me for what follows, which is an abbreviated point-by-point story of how we got this far, how we got to where we are now with the presidential candidates trying to friend as many people as possible on sites like Facebook and attempting to incorporate social networking and social media strategies into their campaign. So very short, it'll read like a children's book. Please forgive me if I leave something out. In 2000, John McCain discovered that you can use the internet to fundraise. Fundraising became a big deal in presidential campaigns. In 2004, Howard Dean reinforced the idea that you can use the internet for fundraising and also discovered that you can use the internet to create communities of volunteers and get those volunteers to do things for the campaign. The Bush campaign watched what Howard Dean was doing and realized that in addition to just getting volunteers for a presidential campaign, you could also use the internet to push get-out-the-vote efforts. At the same time, John Kerry was experimenting with using online advertising and email to get people to donate and cultivate his base of support. In 2006, the Macaca moment happens. In 2007, about a year ago, each of the presidential candidates currently in the race decided that they needed to set up profiles on sites like MySpace and Facebook, and that they needed to have videos on YouTube. And that is the short story, very abbreviated. I know I left a ton of crap out, but that brings us up very quickly to where we are today. And for where we are today, I'm going to turn to Colin Delaney. Colin, we seem to have battling tech candidates this election. We have Ron Paul, whose supporters have raised tremendous amounts of money online. We have Barack Obama, who seems to be running a pretty savvy bottoms-up campaign with a little bit of the top-down, controlling what's going on and giving some shape to what's going on. What do you see happening with the two tech candidates of this election, Paul and Obama, and their uses of social media and social networks?
Well, first, I just want to thank everybody for making it out here on Daylight Savings Day. I tried to wear a bright shirt to wake everybody up. I hope that works. So, and we're going to look at Ron Paul and Barack Obama a little bit. Can you go ahead and? I pulled it. We're going to cover a lot of ground really fast. So, I pulled together a bunch of resources on my site. A bunch of the things we'll be talking about today. So, I think it's interesting to look at Paul and Obama for, you know, in and of themselves, but also for what they tell us about what's going on right now. When people who are really into the online politics world, like the peanut gallery in the fourth row over there, have been talking about this sort of thing, the phrase, you know, the questions you see are often phrased in terms of bottom up versus top down versus peer to peer. The classic political world is a very top-driven or top-down approach. You want to stay on message. You don't want other people mucking around in your business. If people go out and start speaking off the cuff, they may say something that will end up in an attack ad against you. Within the tech world, there is a natural bias toward the bottom-up approach. As particularly, you can definitely see that with people whose sort of founding political experience was in the Dean campaign. But while the campaigns are doing, you know, a million different things, bottom up and top down, you also have peer-to-peer discussions going on. And that's the thing that I found absolutely fascinating, is how people this political season are acting on their own, and in ways that the public doesn't actually see. You know, I think I'd say Facebook is a very interesting example. And obviously Adam's going to talk about this. But campaigns have tried to use Facebook as a broadcast tool, as a mobilizing tool. But their response rates for that are much, much, much lower than for their email lists. But what Facebook has been fascinating about is the peer-to-peer discussion, is people spreading messages, you know, to their friends. But let's start with, you know, going into the candidates themselves. Ron Paul has been, you know, a bit of a phenomenon. Especially in a city like Austin, I'm sure that the Ron Paul crowd is well represented. Definitely around DC, it was a fascinating thing to watch happen. You had this niche of people out there who felt unrepresented, and a candidate came along who spoke to them, and without even trying, without even the campaign trying anything, this massive, geographically distributed group of people took action on their own. They raised $30 million for him in the fourth quarter of the year, which is more than any other Republican. And the campaign didn't really do very much to make that happen. That was his actual followers. They did some amazing things, like, they had a blimp that you could track online, the Ron Paul blimp. Which, did it ever come to DC?
They said it would come to DC, but I don't think they realized you can't fly over DC airspace.
We have those airspace restrictions or something like, yeah. You might blimp bomb the Capitol, which happens all day. So, but the really fascinating thing to watch was, you know, Paul did not have to do a lot of the things that political campaigns have to do online, because the followers were doing it for themselves. They were using Meetup, they were using YouTube, they were organizing themselves. The Obama campaign has gotten a lot of criticism from kind of political social media purists for being much more top down. But what's fascinating to me to see is the extent to which they've mixed these models. They are trying to script the ways that people talk about their candidate, but they're giving them the tools to go out and spread the word on their own. They built their own internal social network. You know, they've raised money from over a million people so far. Within their social network, people are having fundraising competitions. But, you know, we talk about fundraising, we suddenly look at where the traditional political world and, you know, our internet world collide, because to a lot of political professionals, the internet is basically a giant cash machine, right? They don't see it as a place for people to spread messages, for people to organize. They see it as a place to raise money so that they can go spend that money on television ads. The Obama campaign also brings up kind of a darker side of the peer-to-peer discussion, because one of the things that he has run into is this extended email campaign behind the scenes, person to person, trying to smear him as some kind of Manchurian candidate who is going to, he's a secret Muslim, and as soon as he becomes president, the terrorists win.
Oh, you mean Barack Hussein Obama?
Excuse me, Barack Hussein Obama. I'm sorry, I misspoke. I had heard that within the political world, there's a special type of dark arts people called opposition research, and their job is to go out and find everything bad about the other guy. In Obama's case, his first two opposition people that he hired were put on this email. As in, counter these viral emails. Nobody knows where they're coming from, but they're going from your uncle to your cousin behind the scenes. And the only way that you can counter those, because you obviously can't stop them, is just to get a message out there. But this is one of those sort of quiet things where citizens are, you know, taking action on their own, but in ways that, you know, we wouldn't necessarily find terribly helpful. So. Again, I would say that looking at Ron Paul, looking at Obama, Paul shows the power of a distributed group of people taking action on their own. Obama shows the power of marrying the kind of intensity of support with central guidance, and also a very well integrated set of features. If you sign up for an Obama list, they will send you the kind of message you want. If you want to get text messages, you get text messages. If you want email, you get email. If you want Facebook messages, you get Facebook message. That they have broken down a lot of the silos that divided different ways of communicating with people within the campaign. And the other thing that's the thing that I have on my resource page here that I've spent a lot of time on is the citizen-generated videos. From the very beginning, Obama has sparked people into great flights of creativity. Everything from Bollywood mashups to the lovely and legendary Obama girl, who is, of course, I'm a huge fan of. And then you'll see things with where, you'll see where you end up with action and then counteraction. There was a very popular video put together by one of the guys from the Black Eyed Peas in favor of Obama. It's quite moving. And then within 2 or 3 days, somebody comes out with a parody of that about John McCain. So it's the sort of cycle of creativity is very short now. And it's going to be absolutely fascinating to see what comes out over the next 8 or 9 months.
Okay. So my notes from your talk, Colin, are it's all about the money.
Yes.
Some campaigns just allow their supporters to spontaneously join in communities and networks. Others like to be more involved. And there's this new form of political activism called creating content online on behalf of your candidates. Now, we know that not all of the presidential candidates seem to be as savvy as Obama and Ron Paul. They're all doing very interesting things in their own ways. One of the things that Colin mentioned is this internal social network. We have a lot of candidates with these internal social networks. Clinton has one. McCain has one. Edwards had one. But what makes these campaigns different is that they have been accused of running too much of a top-down campaign. And too much of a top-down campaign seems to be a little less tech-savvy. Patrick, what do you see going on with this top-down campaign style?
Well, I think you would have to look at Hillary Clinton, right, as the epitome of the top-down campaign. I think, you know, they started this campaign very much looking to the Bush-Cheney campaign as an example of, you know, what they were going to do and the kind of campaign they were going to run. And I think it's had mixed results, but I think it's had some good results and certainly run into some limitations. You know, we don't think of Hillary Clinton as somebody who, you know, directly engages social media. If she has a Twitter account, but as she's following zero people. So if I follow her, she doesn't follow me back. Barack Obama follows me back. You know, it's those small things that they don't do. But one thing that they do well is the email list. Building up the email list as big and as you know, as large and as influential as it can possibly be. Probably, you know, I think they announced 1 million supporters back in September. I'm sure that's probably doubled by now. Now, what does this mean? Because the vast majority of action on the internet is not social media. It's not Facebook. It's not Twitter. It's, you know, a single supporter going to Googling somebody, going to their website, seeing the nice join the team or seeing the splash page, which asks them to sign up for emails and say, yeah, sure, I'm a supporter. I'm going to enter my email address and my zip code. I'm probably never going to go back to the website. I mean, if on most of these sites, especially if they're more top down, especially if they're more focused on presenting content as opposed to building community, they're probably going to check it out once. But that doesn't matter so much as long as you can get their email address and be able to mail them on a regular and consistent basis. You know how much you're going to fundraise off of that list. And that's been the crux of their strategy. And it's been certainly a top-down approach, but if you had to say this, if there's a good top-down, it's probably been them. I mean, in terms of creating, you see these cheesy videos, you know, with Bill scarfing down a cheeseburger or, you know, the Sopranos video. The entire intention of that being that we're going to drive more traffic to our site. Half the time, we're not going to post these things on YouTube because that's just driving traffic to YouTube and not to us. And get people to sign up for the emails, you know. And then once we get people to sign up for the emails, we're going to fundraise like crazy off of that list. As a result, since Tuesday, she's raised $6 million online after winning the Ohio primary and sort of winning the Texas primary. So
full disclosure, I work for a union that endorsed Hillary Clinton, so in a moment I'll address it. Cool. I've just been here for the last month working on that project.
No fighting.
No. We're all friends. Sorry, Patrick.
But that's and obviously after Super Tuesday, she was able to raise over $10 million in 3 days after she announced a loan to her campaign, actually showed, you know, some vulnerability. And the community loosely defined as all these individuals who are on her email list, not really interacting with each other, but just receiving messages from the campaign, sprung into action. So I think they've definitely realized that this is, for the vast majority of people on the internet, it's clearly we've seen how she's winning older voters, she's winning women, she's winning people who, you know, not traditionally considered your early adopter crowd, but are still active on the internet. They're active through email, and they're getting they're getting the messages, and they're responding to them. Maybe not quite as much as Obama. You know, maybe I don't like her campaign quite as much as Obama, but it's, you know, it's pretty. It shows the viability of a top-down approach when you might not have a candidate. You're not going to have a candidate like Obama in every single race. I'm not saying I endorse that approach necessarily, but I think it's shown that if you can leverage your celebrity, if you can leverage your status, you can get a lot of support online, even if you don't, you know, have all the, even if you don't Twitter, even if you don't do all the bells and whistles.
So 2 weeks ago at a New Democrat Network event, Joe Trippi, who rose to fame running the Howard Dean campaign and inspiring part of its web efforts, said the Clinton campaign would be the last campaign in Democratic history to run a top-down effort. Patrick, you seem to disagree with that a little bit. Sometimes it makes sense to be more top-down. When Trippi said this, of course, it was 2 weeks before Ohio and Texas occurred, and it truly did look like Clinton would eventually bow out.
I think we focus a lot on the presidential race, but we have to remember, you know, there's 33, 34 Senate seats up this year, all 435 seats for the House, and in many of those cases, you're not necessarily going to have in every single race, you know, candidates who inspire this huge groundswell of grassroots activism. And so, from the perspective of a political consultant, and I'm not necessarily, you know, again, not necessarily endorsing it because I've, you know, sometimes run butt up against this kind of perspective. From that kind of perspective, they'll come back and say, well, you know, we're not necessarily going to get a bunch of people excited and involved around this congressional candidate. So it does maybe make more sense to do a more top-down approach. So I think, you know, this idea of, I think there's certainly a potential. I think in every race, there's a potential for somebody to come in to capitalize on that macaca moment that you have to be prepared for. You know, that certainly could happen in every race. That's not saying it will happen in every race. And, you know, if you look at it from the perspective of somebody who runs campaigns, you know, I mean, they're still looking at, you know, the top-down approach.
So politics isn't always as sexy as we would like it to be. And sometimes control helps. And politicians and political candidates and their campaign staff aren't always as interested in creating community online as they are in getting your email address and getting you to give them money. Adam, is any of this new? We've seen this incredible rise this year in Facebook activism and MySpace and YouTube. Is there something new about it, or is this just politics as it is?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, you started off with a Trippi quote there a few minutes ago, and that makes me look bad because I was also going to give a Trippi quote, because that's what you do at political internet events.
Trippi
you give Trippi quotes, and you butcher them.
It gives good.
But no, I think that looking at the 2008 campaign, as we all have been rightly focused on with the presidentials, I see it much more as an evolution than a revolution. And Joe Trippi had said something to this effect, I believe, at the NDN event, that if Dean was in 2004 was the Wright brothers, you know, the first moment of flight, and Barack Obama is landing on the moon. So there's this, you know, the Wright brothers in flight was the revolution, and the evolution of that was the moon. But the space between them is massive. And I think you're seeing that. You know, a lot of the technologies that we're seeing being used in 2008 to such great effect got their start in 2004, 2000. And what we're seeing is a mass adoption. We're seeing the huge numbers that we hadn't imagined before. And that in and of itself, I think, is a true innovation. And something that we're all watching very closely. But I want to take a step back from the kind of day-to-day tactical looking at the campaigns and talk a little bit about this new idea and the fundamental building blocks. At Facebook, we come of the idea that the human connection between people is the kind of the fundamental human building block of relationships in society. And that's a concept as old as human beings themselves. And I think that applies too in campaigns. And at Facebook, we have this concept called the social graph. It's the idea that if you mapped out all of the connections between people, how they share information, how they know each other, you'd end up with a map of very literally billions of connections. And once you've mapped that, you can figure out how to make that information move more efficiently, to make it easier to share with people. And I think that the Facebook has shown that, and that campaigns can really use that to their advantage, and not just at their advantage, but to see how people are talking about politics in a way that we've never been able to observe before. One of the things you'll notice is that people have these conversations online and off without the campaign, no matter what's going on. And you see these conversations. I would throw an example. We partnered with ABC News to create a political application that has a discussion board on it. And on Super Tuesday, the night of Super Tuesday, we had 100,000 people give responses to various questions we posed out there in one night in about 2.5 to 3 hours. But those were just the people who were having a conversation in the public space. Now, there are people out there having peer-to-peer conversations, I think that Colin alluded to, that have been going on, you know, in various forms since we've been talking about politics, and that you don't get to see, but I think you can't ignore the power of them by any means of the imagination. Another not new idea is the idea that peer-to-peer influence and neighbor-to-neighbor contact is more influential than just a paid message from a campaign. So we know that your neighbor telling you about George Bush is more influential than a canvasser who's paid to come to your door and read talking points. And we saw this a little bit in the 2004 campaign with Bush-Cheney and the neighbor-to-neighbor program they kind of instituted. And I know that Patrick could talk a little bit more about that. And I think that Facebook allows you to harness this in a way like really never before. And to really encourage people to understand that these conversations are, again, already happening. And it's not something you don't want to cede to anyone else. And when we talk about top-down model and bottom-up model and social media, I think it's important to realize that there are advantages to both approaches to be used. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that you should run an entire campaign on Facebook. That would be a bad decision. But you should integrate it into various aspects, whether they be field, communication, and other things. And I think you've seen particularly the Obama campaign do this with some measure of success. You know, if you look at things as simple as advertising, I did some number polling a few weeks ago before February 5th, Super Tuesday, where 24 states had their primary. And I pulled some numbers, and there were about 10 million Facebook users in those states over the age of 18 who you could target for about the price of 3 days worth of television advertising. Now, and could target much more precisely and have much better metrics than you could just by running a TV ad. Now, obviously, you shouldn't run just Facebook ads, but I think there's something to be said about being one of the people running Facebook ads to these 10 million people, as opposed to the 30 or 40 ads you got every commercial break leading up to Super Tuesday in one of those states. And I think the other thing is the kind of sexy thing lately in politics has been micro-targeting, and I know that we have a micro-targeting expert here. You know, I was hearing Michael Turk from the Bush campaign speak at IPTE a few days ago and saying, you know, with 150 characteristics that he could buy from data resellers, he could precisely target and understand the appeals and how you were likely to vote and different things like that. If you vote if you bought a Saab versus if you bought a Ford and that sort of thing.
But bourbon drinkers tend to be Republican. Gin drinkers tend to be Democrats.
What about Miller High Life?
But the amazing thing is your friends instinctively know how to target you. How to craft their message to you because they're your friends, and that's the social connection you have there. So your friends, your peers, your social network can precisely message to you in a way that's, I think, cheaper and more efficient than micro-targeting. Now, this isn't to say that you shouldn't be advertising. You want to push this to a space to people who might not see it, who you might not have influence over otherwise. But the concept of a bottom-up campaign means empowering these supporters who are having these conversations that already, and I think Colin put it best once in a post he wrote, you give up control of the words, but you keep control of the message in a way. And to think that you ever had control of the message was always an illusion. It's just that much more transparent of illusion now. So I think as we reach this generational point where people are growing up or fast adapting to it, you just, it's a space that can't be ignored, and I think is having a big influence.
So good political strategy in 2008 marries traditional tactics with geek tactics and produces tools that enable your supporters to carry the message for you. Is that right?
I would say so.
All right. Well, let's just test this out a little bit quickly before we seg into Tanya's presentation. And let's do an unofficial survey of the people in this room. So the title of this panel is Friend Me, Vote For Me, Donate Now. So a show of hands, how many of us have friended a candidate on a social networking site? And how much of us have donated to that candidate? And how much of us have created content on behalf of that candidate on YouTube? And now the final question is how many of us actually went out and voted for that candidate in the primaries? So we have what do you think, Tanya? We have a pretty pretty politically engaged audience today.
And absolutely.
So my question for you is it all about finding the right network, the right collection of people?
I think so. I tend to think so. So this is stepping back from the partisan part of what we're talking about. And I do a lot of work with women in technology. There aren't as many of us as I wish there were. I think that demographic is shifting. In fact, yesterday we were talking about how geek chic or geeky girls are kind of chic now. So that's going to be the first time in my life that I was ever cool. Because I'm a big nerd, I was just talking with a couple of my friends and was thinking about the ways that we engage online. And so I'm going to basically talk about how men and women engage differently online. There are some differences and some similarities. And sort of tying into what's been talked about here, I think that the online world is really sort of starting to mature, and now it's not just building things for the sake of building things, but to use them as tools and to integrate them with sort of previous methods of organizing and things of that nature. But that, you know, as we're coming of age online, that we can be a lot more specialized in how we do things. And so I threw together like an online survey, and it's called How Web 2.0 Are You? Yes, it's on SurveyMonkey. Yes, it's a little lo-fi, but, you know, it's cool. So I'm going to show a couple of slides from the results. So the first thing I sort of intuitively thought was, okay, men and women, we're totally different in the way that we communicate, okay? And so this question was, I use emoticons or emotions in my online communication. That's like if you text, SMS, you know, IM each other. And as you can see, there's a pretty dramatic difference. You know, women tend to very often or often use emotion to couch the sort of language that they're communicating, even if it's just a text message, whereas men, not so much. And I have it on pretty good scientific observation that every male in the very often probably has a girlfriend, which is why they use emoticons. But then, you know, sort of going one step further, you know, how often do you get your friends to donate to good social causes online? Kind of interesting that women don't do it as often as men, apparently. But that all of us, and this was given, I'll talk about recruitment in a little bit in terms of who my survey respondents were. But these are pretty savvy folks that I was asking to take my survey. And it was given online, so you figure they've probably got some level of internet, inner tube savvy. And I used the web to get my friends to volunteer. Again, kind of similar results. You know, we don't seem to be using it as a tool as often, or at least won't respond on a survey, random survey. Although men apparently use it more than women to get their friends to volunteer. Okay, so this is where things start getting kind of interesting, and we go into understanding parts of the social graph, as Adam mentioned. How many friends do you have online? And by that, I mean people that you're connected to on LinkedIn, Facebook, MySpace, the whole gamut. Turns out men respond that they have more than 500 friends. So on the far left is more friends, up to 500 and beyond. And on the right is less than 50. And I think it's kind of an interesting separation here where men tend to respond that they have more friends online than they do than do women, and that the second question, follow-up question I asked was how many do you consider to be friends in real life? And on average, of all the respondents, the average number women responded to, they said about 43 of them, right? Whereas men said 60. Now, the, you know, citizen behavioralist in me has to say that, you know, there is sort of a trend at work here where men will tend to respond that they have more friends than they actually do because it's socially desirable, whereas women tend to be a little bit more realistic in their assessment. So the research says, but that it's kind of interesting because, you know, there is a lot of emphasis in a lot of the work I'm sure that all of you do, where there's a lot of emphasis placed on list building. We definitely want, you know, magnitude, a size of a list to blast out a big message or to do fundraising, things of that nature. But when it comes to online versus offline action, or even online to online action, where you're asking people to take action, I think the thing that I noticed that brings us to the next point, which is which list of all the lists that I went out and recruited from, which one performed the best? Okay, so we've got three kind of groups to protect the innocent. I'm just going to call them Group A, Group B, and Group C. So Group A is a gang of feminist web and tech geekettes, much like myself. And they're less than about 300 members all told on those lists. Group B is a bunch of lefty political bloggers that are mainly a bunch of white dudes, 650 plus members. And Group C is a diverse lefty and large group of political nonprofit do-gooders, about 1,800 members. And Patrick, I did do some outreach to the Republican side, and they were very great at taking my survey. Unfortunately, they were way outnumbered by everybody else, but such is life. So you've got these three groups. Now, I'm going to take a poll, another non-scientific poll of the room. Which, and by perform the best, I mean what, which list actually took the most action, like proportionally, right? Which one engaged, which one actually took the survey? Okay, and some of you might have already heard the results, so let's not spoil it for everyone else. Yeah. Okay, so how many people think that Group A was the best performing list? Okay, and how many people think Group B, political bloggers? A few of you. And how many Group C, which is the whole kit and caboodle? Okay. Now, the answer is, of course, Group A. That's right, because so the moral of the story is small is beautiful. And by that, I mean, you know, tightly knit networks with a high degree of trust are more likely to take action. These are, some people call them super activists, but these folks are really important that you cultivate them because I take the method when I'm looking at a population and wanting to move a message in perhaps non-traditional ways, that you want to take that group of, that small, tightly knit group, because they will pass the message faster and more accurately and more persuasive than if you blast it to an entire list. And I think the trust factor is really key. And I think that's it. I had a whole lot of other things, but that's really the sort of the moral of the story is that, you know, we spend a lot of time and a lot of money cultivating huge lists, but when it comes to actually like taking action, and there are about 15 bajillion other qualifiers that I have to say to this slightly non-scientific anecdotal study that I ran. So I encourage your questions after the panel.
Can I sum you up?
Sure. Yes,
men lie about the size of their lists.
Yeah, they do.
Okay, so lessons from Tanya's presentation. Men lie about the size of their list.
I really don't want that to be this
small. Small is beautiful, and when it comes to developing a political social strategy online, that element of trust is incredibly important. And one final thing that every single one of the speakers have mentioned so far, and that is driving people towards your list. The list seems to be golden. What are we as political operatives using this list for other than to send you fundraising emails? Well, I think that there's this hope that in addition to fundraising online, in addition to turning people out to vote, the political community can use that list and use the internet to bypass the mainstream media, to get messages to spread virally, whether they're negative messages about a candidate or positive messages about a candidate. So my question for the entire panel is, what's with this viral stuff? It seems a little bit silly. It seems like the political community is, what, 2-3 years behind everybody else?
Well, it seems like there is an X factor, and an X factor that's, and that is community. And that obviously the difference between Clinton and Obama's list, I think between their lists, is probably negligible or, you know, explainable by, other factors. But the thing that I think has enabled Obama to get a ton more buzz. Like if you look at Yahoo's, web search breakdown, he's leading 77-21. Web traffic, he's leading 63-37. They got about the same amount of votes. Their lists are both pretty good. But what enables it is the community, and like you said, the small communities, the intent you want to have, even if you're a political candidate that is looking to get 50% plus one, you'd still rather have the 100 people who care deeply and passionately about you and will do anything for you versus the 1,000 people who really are like, yeah, sure, I'll support him. But because those 100 people are going to become 1,000, they're going to become 10,000, and the 1,000 people are going to stay the same or get peeled off by more compelling candidates and causes, especially in the primaries, which I think has been a great testing ground for a lot of this, because pretty much everybody at some point or another is a swing voter in a primary. Mm-hmm. So you can actually use the internet to persuade people. In a general election, it's going to be a lot less interesting, more like a game of inches, because 98% of the people are going to be already persuaded.
Right. And I think actually one of the interesting things that was on Boing Boing this week was a post about the 1,000 true fans and the idea that in the long tail model, there's some people who are going to have the commercial side of it and, various niches in there. But the sustainable model of trying to find like 1,000 true fans who will really be there for you and donate to you and help support you. And I think for a political candidate, particularly one that's not a Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, that's a much more sustainable model. I call them, if you come from the field world in politics, your ones and twos are your rock solid supporters, and your threes are your neutrals, and your fours and your fives are your opponents, and your digital ones and twos and how you self-identify them. Let's say you throw up a Facebook page and haven't done anything to it yet because it's the first day of your campaign. Those 10 to 15 people who find you on their own, who self-identify to you that they're interested, are going to be more valuable and take more action, one would imagine, than those who you've gone out and found later through persuasion or through advertising or different things. And I think that they can hold kind of the base there. If you've ever run a list, the people that always take action when you send out a call to action, the kind of super activists that Tanya alluded to, they kind of form the core of your support. Now, how you grow small networks of action into larger networks of persuasion is, I think, the key challenge that we're seeing here, and I think one of the interesting things that we're coming upon.
Well, also, I mean, people talked about this sort of long tail effect, and one of the reasons that I've gathered these videos here is that, for me, one of the fascinating anecdotes from this cycle was what persuaded my sister-in-law to switch from Hillary to Obama. Now, there's the yes we can video has been seen millions and millions of times. It's beautiful, very slickly produced, but that didn't touch Emily at all. She's a Linux geek. So Lawrence Lessig, who's a big name in the South By crowd, did a very dry 15-20 minute presentation. It's basically his slideshow with him talking over it about why he supported Obama. My older brother sent that to his wife, and half an hour later, she walked back into the room and said, "Well, I just donated to Obama." That video was precisely targeted for her. So we pay attention to the very big, sort of mass audience things, but there is this enormous long tail effect with all of these tiny little niches. And within all of those niches, there are people who are influential. And if campaigns can get to those people, and inspire them, those people will go take action on their own. We do run a little danger thinking too much about the presidential campaigns, because what they can do and then what a city council member or a congressional candidate or a state legislator can do are very different. But even those people can benefit from the niches out there. Henry Copeland, South By, he runs a company called Blog Ads. for every political audience, you know, in America, there is a blog. You know, there are tons and tons and tons of local blogs. Local candidates can be out there using those to find, you know, the activists within, you know, their particular community. You're seeing candidates start to use geo-targeting with search ads, that kind of thing. These are things that are available at all levels. Even if you can't spend $500,000 building your internal social network, you can still go out and find people in the communities of interest in which they live.
This still seems like a lot of work, Tanya.
A lot of work.
Yeah, as a professional organizer, these small, high-trust networks, these networks are going to be the ones who can persuade and share a message and get people to donate and get them to turn out to vote?
I totally didn't get the first part of it. Well, it is a lot of work, but much like we have microprocessors, when you build these high trust, super volunteers, super supporters, you can distribute that work, which I think it plays into why it's important to cultivate those folks. And also, as Colin and Adam were talking, I forgot another point to mention, which was that survey that I was showing you about. It was 57% female respondents versus male. And this is after like very aggressive targeting of male respondents. Which kind of brings up another point that I want to highlight, which is why it's important to cultivate not only super users, but women, because we do engage differently online. I think men seem to be, you know, anecdotally, observationally, more prone to creating and putting information up on the internet, right? Okay, so they'll be the ones that create the YouTube video, which is on Colin's page, that's anti-Hillary Clinton. That's all right. Equal time. And actually to mention too, something that wasn't blasted to everyone but was targeted by the Clinton campaign was a video all about Ann Richards, who was a governor here, and sort of a tribute to her. And it definitely, I think, played into a lot of Texan women who may not call themselves feminists, but they'll go out and vote for Ann Richards, and you bet your bottom dollar they're going to go out and vote for Hillary Clinton because they respond well to strong women in power. But that the other thing is that women may not be the ones running the blog, whatever. They might not be the ones posting comments or being very aggressive online, but they tend to adopt the behavior that we call lurkers. And when you ask them for their opinion, they're much more likely to give it to you, to give you details, to give you really important feedback that I think would be incredibly critical to any organization, advocacy or political or whatever it is that you're doing. They're much more willing, I think, to give you their opinion and to participate in polling that will end up helping you build your organization. And certainly in the commercial world, couple of my very good friends work for Procter & Gamble, and they have a whole market segment called the Tremors Group. Okay, Tremors. What does it make you think of? The shaking before the earthquake.
Or and a horrible, horrible movie.
What?
Or a fantastically bad movie.
It was a
fantastically
great bad movie. Yes.
But the point is that, you know, who is this group that they closely target and spend a lot of time with, and they happen to be basically working moms, right? A lot of them live in the Midwest. Some of them are stay-at-home moms, but they're basically moms. And the reason why Procter & Gamble focuses so much time on them is because they do drive an enormous portion of the consumer choices that are made, out in the market. And I think similarly, you know, when you're trying to do something virally online, you know, women tend to, at least in some of the marketing language, they tend to be sneezers. In other words, they will pass information on to other folks. I've been told that's a bad name, but I think it's great.
I think one of the other things, too, to get back to your talk about these small networks, how much work is it and that sort of thing, is the viral component of that. Right. And we're all familiar with the kind of traditional concept of viral, which is, you know, I see an interesting video, I copy and paste the link into an email, I blast 10 friends, maybe they send it on me to download. You know, one of the things we've seen with Facebook that's impressive is with the newsfeed we introduced, which kind of amalgamates the actions of your network and your friends and what they're doing on a central place, it's taken kind of that active component necessarily out of it. And so a great example I like to use is, let's say I find a photo of Patrick and Obama on the internet, and you know, I don't think this exists, but let's say hypothetically.
It'd be cool if it did.
And if it does, you can please email it to me. No, so let's say if Barack Obama had put that on his website, maybe 10 people would have seen it, right? Maybe 10 people have gone through his photo section, found the event that day, and taken a look at it. Let's say the Obama campaign threw it up on Facebook, and Patrick's going through, as I know he sometimes does, and sees the photo and tags himself in it. Now, all of a sudden, on Facebook, all of his friends have been alerted in the feed that hey, here's a picture of Patrick, and oh man, is that Barack Obama? That's kind of cool. And I'm cruising around, and I click, and I'll leave a comment on that. You know, wow, it's really cool you're in a photo with Barack Obama. And now, all of a sudden, it's gone out to both the people in my feed network and his feed network, and all of a sudden, a photo that maybe a dozen people would have seen beforehand has been seen by thousands of people and been interacted with, and for something that wasn't any much more work than just putting it up on a website. So I think that there is also tremendous benefits too, but the idea that I think some people come into this as we adapt to this new technology is that we can just throw up the same things as at broadcasts that we do and expect them to work on the internet. And obviously, you need to adapt your message and techniques to this new environment, just as, you know, scanning a direct mail piece and sending it out as an email doesn't have the same effect as an actual getting a piece of mail. I think the same thing applies as we do online marketing and online advertising and more communication.
Right. And as it's more pervasive, I mean, Julie just ran that was a theme at another conference, is pervasive politics, and is something that I'm constantly fascinated by, is the level of adoption that we have in the general population. That, you know, is your mom yet on Facebook, Adam? I'm just wondering.
No. It's a daily struggle.
It's a daily struggle. Well, you know, but there are people that aren't the typical sort of 18 to 25-year-olds that are on Facebook mm-hmm. now and using it. And it's part of the bandwagon effect, basically, that the viral portion of the news feed is that it's literally, you can see the bandwagon effect as your friends join a group, as your friends tag a photo. That causes that to self-perpetuate itself.
I just want to point out, you know, Adam's mom may not be on Facebook, but my 72-year-old father has a 4,000-person Yahoo group. So you never know who is going to be active. But one thing that we need to keep in perspective, and you know, Ron Paul obviously demonstrates this, that you may have a group supporters who are completely fired up, supporters who are tech-savvy, supporters who are doing everything they can. But if you're trying to sell a product nobody wants to buy, then you're doomed. Ron Paul had, you know, a niche of 5 to 8% of the Republican electorate, and he never got past that, even with $30 million in the bank.
So if you have a question, emphasis on the questions, please come up to the microphone.
Hi there. Politics is obviously getting a lot of attention and very interesting, but I feel as if there's a component missing to the title, which is, you know, friend me, vote for me, donate to me, represent me. And I'm curious as to whether or not you think the bottom-up nature of campaigns will actually translate into government 2.0, White House 2.0, so that all of the people who haven't voted in the past because they felt disillusioned with the representation that Congress or the White House has provided to them will now say, oh, well, we helped elect you, and hey, look, now we're active participants in government. You're representing us better, and we may actually address some of the critical challenges facing the globe.
Sure. I think that before I hand this over to Adam, I think that's a dream that everybody has. But I think that talking to people in the administration, people who work on the Hill, that vision and that dream is incredibly different from the day-to-day realities of running a White House or running an office on the Hill. Adam.
Well, I mean, I think one of the points, and one of my old colleagues who was here at a panel last year at South by Southwest, is the level of technical knowledge in on the Hill and in presidential administrations is shockingly low. You know, the people who write tech policy in America, the people who are dealing with these issues day to day, are shockingly low. The rules in Congress where I used to work, for instance, for the internet, to govern the websites of the House, were written in 1995, before most of the technology on the internet was even existed. So we run up into those kind of systematic barriers too that make it have a huge impact on it too, and how it's not worth the hassle. So why bother at this point once they're in office?
At the State of the Net conference in January, Congresswoman Mary Bono Mack got up and said, as an elected official, I can tell you that most of us don't get technology. We don't know the right questions to ask. And I would even add that perhaps there isn't a culture of valuing technology and the implications of technology that would go into creating better tech policy, not just as a nation, but as an elected official.
And also, I mean, given the obsessive coverage, a lot of this is the media too. So, I mean, it's the permanent campaign, right? Because, you know, once this president's elected, we're going to go into the 2012 election cycle immediately. And that's where public attention is going to flow. And it's going to, you know, and that's what people are going to congregate around, because I think that's, you know, what the media is interested in. But at the local level, you know, in New Hampshire, you know, we know New Hampshire for its first in the nation primary status. You know, there is a blog Guilford Grok that all it does is cover the town board, the school board meetings, and has actually been successful in actually getting things reversed and changed because they're actually in there reporting on what's actually going on, and they're letting the sunlight in. All of this stuff is happening. It's kind of happening under the radar, and the government, especially at the local level, it's kind of getting dragged along in the process.
Carl and Tanya, under the radar. Local.
Well, you know, one thing, your question was based on this assumption that there is a bottom-up thing happening, but within the professional political world, the vast majority of political communicators don't think that way. And so when, you know, they move into Congress, they don't, it doesn't, you know, a bottom-up approach isn't even on, you know, in the back of their mind. Right now, a lot of congressional offices, you can't even directly email. They have basically blocked access to it. So we are, and you know, while you will see instances like the Dean campaign or the Obama campaign or the Ron Paul campaign where you do get a spontaneous firestorm out there, the vast majority of candidates are just trying to get noticed. And they are going to be running a very centralized, driven campaign just as they have been for, you know, the last half century.
And I think the process, too, at D.C. moves a lot slower than the technology does. Yeah. And you've got to think this is actually a group of the most sort of risk-averse people you could ever meet. I mean, they're not going to launch some new technology in a campaign. They may not be as prone to launching some sort of technology, although it would be huge for constituent services. And I think some of the more progressive members are adopting that. But I know it's crazy, especially to say at this conference, but a lot of business gets done from phone calls or face-to-face, F2F. I think is what
and
it's
alcohol
called.
Alcohol doesn't hurt.
Yep. Right, yeah. I mean, one of the things that I when I'm talking to clients, you know, sometimes you need to do, you know, online organizing. Sometimes you just need to hire a good lobbyist.
Okay, so we have 9 minutes left, and we want to get to all of the questions. So I promise that I'll limit our responses to 30 seconds to a minute.
Similar question. Do you think there'll be a trend that people that are embracing the two-way web right now are going to demand from their campaigns and their elected officials more, you know, be able to be part of that position framing and message making more than they're allowed today? And we've heard a lot on the campaign trail that people saying they're interested in having a conversation with a million people. Is that a genuine interest, or what are the tools that you've seen work to make that happen, which is kind of a hard task?
I mean, I think you run into an inherent contradiction on some level. You want a principled politician who doesn't change his positions, but, you know, you come in there and maybe take an online poll on how I should vote for this. It doesn't seem like that's something that, you know, I think would be great, but doesn't seem like the way we've constructed the system will work necessarily well.
Colin?
Got nothing.
Tanya, next question.
Can you please comment on how you identify failures or mistakes that are made online and how you measure those?
Whether you win or lose.
Well, do you mean, I actually have a clarifying question. Do you mean like when the technology fails or when, like, Julie mentioned the macaca moment. So it's like what's interesting about the web is that when there are these failures or missteps that YouTube has allowed for an enormous amount of sunlight to be put on that.
What made me think of it was your comment on the Ann Richards video. You lost one of five women that I know in Texas by running that video.
You lost them. One in five?
They associated it with Weekend at Bernie's, you putting words in a dead person's mouth.
Oh, I see. Okay, well,
I don't know if that was the opinion of most women in Texas.
Well,
it wasn't, but for me it was a significant amount, and it just made me wonder how you identify mistakes when people just disappear. Mm-hmm. And do you measure that? Is it timely? Because this is all moving so quickly. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing technology that measures things that don't work, and how do you adjust mm-hmm. for that?
Well, I think kind of like what Colin said, if you lose, you know you did something wrong.
Right. But you can.
That's a 2009 answer.
I think blog monitoring. I mean, you want to go blog and discussion groups. There are public places where you can gauge opinion. And just as, you know, commercial marketers are monitoring their brands, you know, how their brands are being discussed online, that the candidates are watching that. Actually, I've heard on good authority that Nancy Pelosi et al. Are terrified of the liberal blogs. Because, you know, they'll beat up on them and gin up primary opponents.
Right. So. And the political community is entirely too obsessed with polls for its own good. I mean, if a poll's 2 hours old, it's too old.
It is. Okay, thank you.
Hi, I have two questions, actually. One is for Adam from Facebook. Mm-hmm. In like the past 18 months or so, Facebook has lifted the restrictions on how to message the groups. You've introduced fan pages and the causes application has really sort of blown up. My nonprofit organization, Kaboom, is on all three. And we, on each one, we have radically different number of friends that are associated with it and radically different ways to interact with them. And it's becoming a bit of a problem as me, who, you know, tries to focus my efforts in different things, which group I want to go for and stuff like that. And I was wondering if you could possibly provide any insight in which one you think is the best. Or or maybe some ways, like, for me to try and consolidate. Because I love Facebook, and there's a lot of things about Facebook I want to push with my group and how people interact on our site and Facebook and all that sort of stuff. So I was wondering just the sort of insights on how to consolidate my presence as a nonprofit on Facebook.
Right. Well, and I'm happy to talk to you afterwards, too, to give you a little more time because I don't want to bore everyone here with things. But, you know, I think there are some great benefits there. I think I would say leveraging your existing supporters is the key to the growth there. And it, as you have, you know, fans and friends and groups and different things, you know, doing unique things with that. And I think also the great thing about the fan page is the ability to broadcast message to everyone who's a follower of you, and using that as a messaging tool is, I think, a great thing too.
My second question is, my cause, it's pretty fresh, it's pretty new, it's not a sort of decades long sort of thing. And as we try to push forward with our messaging and with our sort of positions, we're really trying to use online a lot and stuff like that. And so we don't, like, the list that we have is very, very small, very, very organic. And so when we start talking about things like bottom up and top down and stuff like that, a lot of those terms feel like they're great social strategies for established organizations or established groups, established candidates or anything like that. If I had to pick one or maybe a combination of those sort of three things.
Okay.
So something is, I'm trying to grow, right?
Well, and yeah. I think you're completely bottom up, and that's a wonderful thing. Yeah. I mean, if you've got, you know, 100 people on your list and you spend a lot of time with those 100 people, you're going to end up having a resource that's going to recruit more. I mean, if you spend even time with 50 of those people that end up opening, you know, most of the email and ask them to do, like we always do, sort of tell a friend kind of thing. Tell a friend actually is a very useful tool. But, you know, spending a lot of time with them and making them feel really bought into whatever cause it is you're trying to promote, I think is a great way to grow your list.
But basically you want to sit down and just think about, you know, the array of tools that are out there. And then the strengths of your, I mean, this is just communications 101, the strengths of your organization. For instance, a lot of nonprofit policy groups have done well. Center for American Progress is a great example, have done well with blogs because they have people who are writing really good content all the time. If you're a three-person nonprofit and nobody's a good writer, a blog's a bad strategy. So, you know, you want to match the tools that you use to, you know, to your own, what you're good at. And I have a published hourly rate if you want to talk about it later. Yeah.
So we're running out of time. So let's get the final two questions and then we'll answer them.
You mentioned that most business in DC is done via phone calls. I find that our political system and our media environment make it very, very hard to do business via email. The media loves a soundbite and the politician is terrified of something being taken out of context and used as a soundbite against them. Do you have any suggestions for how to either help the politicians feel more safe or help the media quit setting up for politicians in this way? And then I think you could see more business done on email, but how would you make that happen?
I think we're actually getting better at this in terms of, you know, you sometimes hear the objection internally when you're trying to sell this stuff internally in campaigns. It's like somebody will post a nasty comment, you know, on our blog and, you know, that'll get put in an attack ad. I mean, but I think that the volume is now such that, you know, it's such a massive volume. And I think political reporters don't necessarily want to deal with this crap. You know, they don't want to troll through every single social networking, you know, node on your internal social network and to find a nasty comment. That's just inherently not a good use of their time. So I do think, you know, that the system is adapting kind of slowly. But then you know, for every kind of online blow up, you have like a Samantha Power, somebody who's like associated with kind of the formal policy structure of the campaign says something that's drastically off message. So I do think, you know, that's still, those are still the big blow ups and still the big issues.
Last question.
Hey, kind of a technical question, more about tools. Why are campaign managers out there? It's great to go to Facebook and MySpace and YouTube, but what about social search and the future of that, like aggregation tools like Prophylactic, RenFeed? Why aren't they using those where you can see everything Obama did online rather than go foxhole to foxhole to foxhole?
I think you're probably going to see more of that as we're, as someone said, we're a couple of years behind the curve.
Tanya's completely right about risk averse. I mean, a presidential campaign, I mean, this year, you know, they've gone on three times as long as normal, but a campaign just lasts a few months. And you got to win, you know? You must win. That is why you are there. So you're not there to experiment. You're not there to play games. I come out of the online advocacy world, you know, in D.C. There are thousands and thousands of nonprofits. You see a lot more experimentation there because they're building a message. They're building support over a period of years. But campaigns are not going to take risks because they have to win.
And I would say also one of the things holding us back just in general is if you have ever been at a campaign meeting or the higher level of a campaign, internet directors traditionally don't have the same stature as a communication director, yeah, a field director. They don't have the ear of the candidate or the campaign manager necessarily. And that's a huge thing in a personal interaction where a lot of the decisions of a campaign are made. You know, they may be called an internet director. That doesn't mean they have the same pull or punch. And so as we go forward, we hope to see more of them in higher level positions and more communications directors who understand the importance of the internet or field directors and things like that. But it's a gradual process, and we are still relatively new to this process.
And more candidates and elected officials who understand and appreciate the technology as well.
Patrick had a great article back, I think, in the spring or summer, Don't Hire an Internet Person, basically that online thinking should be in the back of all of your communications people's mind. But we're just not there yet. In 4 years, maybe, 6 years, 8 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of, I mean, it's an evolutionary process. I mean, I think we are moving towards a period of time, or maybe it's 10 years from now, or you know, a couple election cycles, maybe even the next election cycle, where, you know, the chief strategist on a campaign used to be the media consultant, used to be the pollster. I think it'll be not necessarily the internet consultant, not necessarily the person who builds the website, but the person who understands how to communicate across all of these media, whether it's online video, TV, a mail, you name it.
Tanya, yeah. Final word?
Final words. Small is beautiful, folks. Small is beautiful. Spend time with the folks that you can, because they will end up helping you let, you know, a thousand flowers bloom, or whatever the great phrase is. So
wonderful. Thank you, Tanya, Colin, Patrick, and Adam. And thank you for coming out here.
And we'll take it out with a very nice Obama Bollywood mashup.